This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, an unnatural disaster, the U.S. crucifixion of Haiti, part two, the destruction of the state. Before we continue with our coverage of the effects of the earthquake in Haiti, we are joined by Ralph Pointer and our ongoing series about the case of Lynn Stewart. Good morning, Ralph.
Good morning, Maya. I hope that this day finds you well. And we're doing as best as can be done under the circumstances. When we talk about Haiti, we talk about a corrupt government of the United States that's corrupting everything here and there. When you talk about unnatural disasters, we're talking about the unnatural disaster here with a criminal subprime loan. But I will stop there. I was speaking to Lynn last night. She is in good spirits. She's ready to continue. As she said, life can be good. The struggle is the struggle, and that never changes. Our condition within the struggle can sometimes change.
Ralph, since we spoke with you, Lynn's phone privileges were cut off. Could you please describe the circumstances?
Yes, I'll be as clear and succinct as possible. When Lynn first went to prison, she was scheduled to do an operation in New York City, Lenox Hill Hospital. The Second Circuit sent the decision down, report to jail immediately. Although she's been in jail, the paperwork has not followed. This is very unusual. And to report, they said, bring your medicine. We took the medicine. We got there. They say, oh, don't come today. Come tomorrow. Don't bring medicine. Just send us a list of the medicine you need, and we will supply the medicine. We left our medicine at home. We were five blocks from the prison. We get a call. Bring your medicine, because we couldn't get it. This was not so alarming. It could happen. Fortunately, I was able to go get the medicine, come back and give it to her. When she gets in the prison, they change her medicine. They decide the medicine that she was getting was wrong. And then that's when the sickness began. She ended up in the hospital three times. Well, the third time she went to the hospital, her roommate noticed she went to the hospital in the evening and she didn't come back. High blood pressure and fast heart rate. She dared to call me, and I called my daughter, I called the lawyers. I said, you know, like Lynn hasn't been heard from, and she generally called me each day, and her roommate called me, and as a result, the cellmate ended up losing her privileges of phone calls for 3 months and her email privilege, which was about to come on, and Lynn the same thing. For what? For daring to call me to say, hey, I'm concerned about your wife. Lynn has made the first appeal, and she lost, and now she's in the process of doing the second appeal.
And the status of Lynn's case, I understand that a postponement for submission of documents is going to be filed?
Yes, because there may be a change in lawyers, and they'll have to have time for paperwork to take care of this adjustment. And remember, the papers from the Second Circuit down to Judge Codal have not come. Now, we're 2 months in jail, and they're sitting on it. Now, remember, after Lynn's appeal was denied, they sent a second opinion, which said that they wanted the judge to revisit everything in the case to give Lynn more time. They suggested 70 months, as opposed to the 28 months the judge gave her. I asked the lawyers, how can they do something like that and sit on it? And the answer was, they have to do it within a certain number of days or, and this is the or, as soon as possible. So they're sitting on a decision, and I ask an attorney why, this is Liz Fink, why would they do that? And she said they may be doing that because they want to send another opinion that's worse and give her the terrorist treatment, which is 20 years.
Ralph, the significance of the appellate court maintaining the mandate and not turning it over to Judge Codall is that the case still resides with the appellate court. It's not really in Judge Codall's hands, even though he has been told by the appellate court to revisit his sentencing.
Yes, and so we sit here twiddling our fingers because the mandate is still in the Second Circuit, and we cannot progress until Judge Codall has the mandate, the paperwork, where the lawyers can begin, where they can go and appeal to him about her conditions in jail. Because, as you know, I was very angry when they insisted that she go to jail very quick in an unusual manner. And as I told her, I says, I hope they don't start the Mumia treatment. Every rule works for everybody except when it comes to Mumia, and then call it the Lynn Stewart treatment. And I wanted them to work on a furlough for her so she could get her operation in the city, in a hospital of note. This could not be done because Codall does not have the papers to make any decision.
Well, Ralph, as I understand it, an appellate process entails the attempt on the part of the review court to assess the legal characteristics of the trial below and whether there were some violations of due process or law about which they can pronounce. But I do not understand the appellate role to be to usurp the function of the court below, which has heard the evidence, heard the case, and made a ruling. If they rule against the court below, it's supposedly based upon some infraction of legal process or some violation of rights, something that has a legal or juridical content. But in this case, the Second Circuit judges seem to be substituting themselves for the court below. They're trying to dictate the sentence. If they uphold the ruling, the sentence is not their call. They're trying to determine what the court below decides as to whether Lynn Stewart is allowed to be on bail while her appeal is pending. They're trying to substitute themselves for the court below's determination of whether she goes to prison when she has medical conditions and so on.
Very well stated, Ralph. That was very clear. Yes, they have usurped the position of the lower court, and they're hanging on to the paper to further usurp the decision of the judge. So, yes, I'm afraid, as I said, we're going to have a new thing, a new standard here, the Lynn Stewart treatment, like the Mumia treatment, Mumia Abu-Jamal, that is, who goes to court, and they violate every law that they have for him.
And then two of these appellate judges were senior law partners in these firms that represent the Fortune 500, the stock exchange. They represent the American government. They represent DuPont. They represent all of the centers of finance and corporate capital in the United States. And they are partners with the judge who gave the 100-year sentence to the sheikh. The very issue about which Lynn is being tried as the lawyer defending that wrongly accused and convicted figure. So the judge below is the senior partner, ongoing associate, financial beneficiary by virtue of that association of two of the judges. And they not only have not recused themselves, but they've taken the lead in demanding a terrorist enhancement and a massive increase in the sentencing. What are we dealing with here, and where is the legal resistance to this outrageous usurpation of judicial authority?
Yes, you covered this so very well in one of the other programs. People should look back to that program to how you have outlined the connections where these gentlemen should have recused themselves. Gentlemen, I misused the word. Where these judges should have recused themselves from being involved, but instead they're taking a lead to extract punishment for Lynn daring to support the Bill of Rights, which they have walked over.
Ralph, we're coming up on Valentine's Day, and I want to take this moment to thank all of you who have been writing to Lynn. She's been getting letters from people worldwide. And now's a good time to flood the prison with Valentines for Lynn Stewart.
I love the idea, Maya. I love the idea. Lynn, L-Y-N-N-E, Stewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T, M-C-C, 150 Park Row, New York, New York, 10007. The number is 53504-054,
The number, when you're referring to a number, is the prisoner number that is assigned to Lynn.
Thank you so much, Maya. This is one of the things that Lynn says lifts her up in this oppressive situation when she reads her mail. You out there in Radio Land, by sending letters to Lynn, have lifted her spirits. Please continue.
Lynn Stewart, prisoner of conscience. Everybody, get to the mails, brothers and sisters,
okay,
and get your friends to do the same.
And thank you so much, Ralph, and I'm going to turn my radio on to get the rest of this program, because they are all so magnificent, and I encourage everybody to hear the wonderful programs that are taking aim. Everyone's so full of information that it's overwhelming. And that program you did to discuss the judges and their connection, I still can't get over it.
Ralph, it's on our website in our current programs about Lynn. We include all the programs so that people have easy access.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you, Ralph.
Bye-bye, Ralph. And now to continue with our program, an unnatural disaster, the U.S. Crucifixion of Haiti, Part 2, The Destruction of the State. Last Wednesday, January 27th, 2 weeks after the January 12th earthquake rocked Haiti, Haiti's President René Préval told a press conference that the Haitian government had buried, rather put into mass graves, 170,000 bodies. 170,000 bodies had been recovered since the January 12th earthquake. Still, many bodies remain in the rubble, while others have been buried without being counted by the government, have been buried by their families. Estimates of the total number of dead range as high as 300,000. 2 weeks after the disaster, however, the majority of the surviving victims have yet to receive any significant aid. This despite the presence of over 15,000 U.S. military personnel and their unilateral assumption of control over the country's airports and port facilities, taking away the role of the Haitian government, essentially leaving the Haitian government to just bury the dead. Ralph?
Well, Maya, on February 2nd, the New York Times, a remarkable editorial called Thinking About a New Haiti. 3 weeks after Haiti's earthquake, the search for survivors has been called off. The TV crews are trickling home. The celebrity telethon is over. And the usual signs that the floodwaters of compassion will be ebbing soon. The United States, Canada, and other nations meeting in Montreal last week vowed that they will map a recovery plan and set the stage for a donor conference in March. They acknowledged the difficult truth. It will take years of help and not aid alone to help pour the foundation of a new Haiti. Haiti is still mostly horror, the editorial continues, a nation of the homeless and maimed. Despite a stunning surge of global aid, many survivors lack water and food and tents, sleep outdoors in a terror of aftershocks, roads, ports, and communications shattered, managers and civil servants who needed to help the recovery all dead, the buildings from which they would run it flattened. But there are reasons for optimism in the rubble, states the New York Times. And it cites Professor Collier having noted that Haiti has considerable economic advantages. What are those, brothers and sisters? Low labor costs and a law that grants its goods preferential access to the United States market. Extending that law and encouraging investment in industries like garment making based upon low wages. And tourism will create tens of thousands of jobs, rebuilding and modernizing agriculture for export to the United States, products like coffee and mangoes that will mean cash and employment. You notice, brothers and sisters, the classic colonial syndrome. Commodity products that are on a world market that the population itself cannot consume based upon starvation and near slave-like wages, as if those wages are not low enough in Haiti. The new Haiti is the old Haiti on steroids, brothers and sisters. And here on the 1st of February, Maya, the New York Times again, in a piece by Ginger Thompson and Mark Lacey. In the quake's wake, Haiti faces a leadership void. The journalists had assembled, the cameras were rolling, seated at center stage with the American ambassador and the American general in charge. Got that? At the back of the room, wearing blue jeans and a somber expression, stood President René Préval, half listening to the updates on efforts to help Haiti recover from its devastating earthquake, while scanning his cell phone for messages and then wandering away without a word. That moment last Wednesday was revealing of a leadership crisis taking hold in Haiti as it faces the task of rebuilding almost every corner of Port-au-Prince, the capital. Foreign nations have sent hundreds of millions of dollars to assistance, only to find the government too weak to harness it. Virtually every symbol of the country's political system has vanished in the rubble. Brothers and sisters, the article says that the parliamentary elections are indefinitely postponed. Radio programs are soapboxes for opposition leaders to strike the government. The nation has been looking forward to a peaceful transfer of power and now is experiencing the rumblings of chaos and coups. A leadership void, brothers and sisters, a military occupation, a martial law demanded by Hillary Clinton, the marginalization and setting aside of the leadership, the nominal leadership in Haiti, a leadership void, a usurpation of authority by a military putsch and a coup in the face of disaster, which they are exploiting for colonial and exploitative purposes of a magnitude not yet experienced in Haiti.
Ralph, the idea that it is impossible to rule in Haiti, to have an indigenous Haitian leadership, is the prevalent statements of all the bourgeois press, particularly the New York Times. In its January 26th article, Agreement on Effort to Help Haiti Rebuild, Mark Lacey and Ginger Thompson write, concerned about corruption and wobbly Haitian leadership, international donors agreed Monday during a meeting in Montreal on a 10-year rebuilding effort for earthquake-damaged Haiti, one that would create an even better capital city and that the government said would cost $3 billion. And note how Thompson and Lacey continue. Given Haiti's long history of mismanagement of funds, international donors were hesitant to write a blank check. And foreign governments had concerns as well about the government's ability to direct a large reconstruction project. What is noted is that they are looking either for total international control or something similar to a Marshall Plan. But what we've seen is that they relegate to the Haitian government only the burying of the dead. I'd like to go back to what you had said about postponing indefinitely the national legislative elections that had been set for the end of February. Prior to the earthquake, the government, that is the government of René Préval, banned from participation in the vote the Fanmi-Lavalas Party, which had supported former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide and of which Préval had been a participant with Aristide. Préval, an agronomist, had been a bureaucrat in the Aristide government. And here we have Préval banning Lavalas, the mass-based party, from participating in the election. Also, at a news conference in Washington last Wednesday, the same day as Préval's press conference, a Pentagon press secretary, Jeff Morrell, indicated that the U.S. military is contemplating a protracted occupation of Haiti and that security still remains its primary concern. While they keep saying that security is the primary concern, there has been no evidence in Haiti of disruption. Let's look at what is going on in Haiti. The real drive, the fact that over 50% of the population is living on less than a dollar a day, that about 80% of the population lives on less than $2 a day, 50% of the population is illiterate. Let's see how this evolved. Ralph?
Well, Maya, you mentioned the role of René Préval with respect to privatization. It's essential for us to understand, brothers and sisters, that from the inception of the Lavalas, from the inception of the mass movement, from the beginnings of the mass mobilization of the general strike in Haiti, when Jean-Bertrand Aristide was thrust into the role of being the voice of the masses in Haiti, he was set before a Hobson's choice by Jimmy Carter and by Alvin Adams, then the ambassador, who, by the way, as we've documented many times in the past, was the author of the Phoenix Program in Vietnam. And Jean-Bertrand Aristide was basically given his marching orders at the time. We'll keep the troops in the barracks on the condition that you maintain the military apparatus of the previous regime, point one, and that you implement faithfully and specifically and in all of its content the privatization and the austerity measures of the International Monetary Fund. Haiti Reborn is an article that we cited and is an extraordinary documentation of this reality. On February 7th, the article states, "The people of Haiti welcome President Jean-Bertrand Aristide into his second term as president. During the last decade, Haitians suffered through a military coup d'etat that left destroyed any progress that had been made in the economy. Now the government of Haiti is in desperate need of money to begin economic development. In addition, President Aristide's government seeks political recognition and acceptance from an international community that has been hostile to him and has imposed neoliberal initiatives, pushing on an open door. They were not merely embraced by Jean-Bertrand Aristide, let it be stated, but they were implemented." As this article states, "Aristide's predecessor, President René Préval, implemented the conditions of international aid during his 5 years as president, continuing the program of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. At the top of the agenda for structural reforms was the privatization of Haiti's 6 major state-owned enterprises: electricity, telecommunications, port administration, the water supply, and the flour mill. Contrary to public belief, Haiti's public enterprises were profitable and efficient. Some of them, it is true, served the elite. For example, only 5% of Haitians had access to a teleco telephone, and only 6% of the entire population had electricity. It is important to note that these public enterprises were neglected over the years, and during the coup, the military leaders closed the cement company, the flour mills, and depended on the water supply company to provide it with extra income. Teleco was very profitable because calls made from the U.S. to Haiti provided $2 million each month in revenue. President Préval gave his blessing to privatize the major state-owned institutions. Popularized organizations and opponents of privatizations have tried to challenge the notion that only privatizing state institutions will make them viable. That's why they're shutting down Lavalas, because the mass movement has not been brought on board. In less than 3 months, the cement factory went from a 4.5 million gourd loss to a 100,000 gourd profit. The flour mill from 2.76 million gourd loss to a 2.1 million gourd profit under public ownership. The International Finance Corporation of the World Bank signed an accord to impose privatization with devastating consequences. The state-owned enterprises privatized, the flour mill sold to 3 companies, 2 from the United States, Seagrain and Continental Grain. These 3 purchased 70% of the company for a mere $9 million, representing a near-liquidation purchase. In addition, the government had to take over the debt of the company, $12 million. In 1984, the mill generated $15 million a year, and at that time, the market didn't represent a quarter of what the market is today. The state-owned Ciment de Haiti, auctioned off by the Préval government, represented an opportunity to increase production because raw materials needed for cement production are easily available in Haiti. The factory itself was located close to quarries that supplied 500,000 tons of cement for 125 years in the future. A study showed that with capital investment of $1 million, the factory would be hugely profitable. What did they do? They sold it off to Swiss-owned Umar Holderback, the Colombia-owned Carl Klinker, and other private companies that have profiteered off of this while reducing the starvation wages to even less than they were before, brothers and sisters. That's the reality. That's the program and the agenda of the International Monetary Fund and of the so-called world community. That's why the U.S. Marines are back in Haiti. That's why the occupation is not a provision of help to the Haitian people, but an imposition of the same conditions it obtained in 1915 with the Marines invading Haiti.
Let's look at some of this austerity imposition on Haiti and its impact, as you've so eloquently described. It goes back to the beginnings of the Aristide government with the Paris Accord of August 1994. And we have to understand and we have to stress again and again that this is the role of former President Bill Clinton. This is what he imposed when he was president and what he is continuing to put into effect in his role as a UN ambassador at large for Haiti. In this Paris Accord of 1994, this document that was negotiated by the World Bank, the IMF, with the Aristide government, called for the drastic, and I stress, in quotes, drastic reduction of tariffs and import controls, and, quote, open foreign investment policy, end quote, aid to the export sector, massive retrenchment in the public sector, and by massive retrenchment, they basically mean the elimination of the public sector, so that today most of the public services, including education, are provided by non-governmental organizations, a panoply of non-governmental organizations without any rhyme or reason or centralized control. The elimination of price controls. Understand that in an impoverished country, it is price controls, especially on food and on fuel, that allows the poor people to even survive. Then wage restraint. That's their terminology for prevention of minimum wage laws. And Aristide tried to increase the minimum wage, and this was opposed by the U.S. government. And also the Haitian parliament recently voted in an increase in minimum wage, which René Préval, as president, refused to implement, which caused massive demonstrations in Haiti. Most importantly, as Ralph is saying, privatization of critical public services. Telecommunications, the construction industry, flour, which provides the bread, all this was to be privatized. Ralph?
Maya, the Haitian Human Rights Platform condemned privatization, noted that the mass movement was a struggle against it, was against the debt, was against privatization, was for public ownership, was for the people having control. And here's their statement, that the government has decided to bow down to the dictates of international financial institutions. The United States government is today a done deal. But our nation is not stupid. These neoliberal measures do nothing to resolve the grave problems of poverty and underdevelopment which affect our country. To want to relaunch agricultural production through this privatization is to ask people to eat their feet to find the strength to run, unquote.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, An Unnatural Disaster, The U.S. Crucifixion of Haiti, Part 2. Ralph?
Well, Maya, I was citing the Haitian Human Rights Organization's extraordinary assault upon the privatization program of both Aristide and Préval's government. It's a resistance of the mass movement, and that's why the coup was made, because Aristide could not be counted upon to carry out the relentless subjugation of the population. He attempted to buy time with them while implementing the IMF's programs with the devastating consequences. Here is the itemization by the Haitian Human Rights Organization of what occurred. 1991, the Aristide Préval government roots out corruption in state institutions. 1991 to 1994, following the 1991 coup d'etat, the de facto regimes engage in looting and embezzlement of the entire economy. The cement and flour factories are shut down. August 1994, representatives of the Aristide government meet with the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and other international agencies in Paris, where they commit to full privatization upon their return to Haiti. February 1995, the International Finance Corporation of the World Bank signs an accord to help the Haitian government implement privatization. August 1995, Prime Minister Smart Michel announces the sale of the cement and flour companies to international private corporations. September 1995, popular and parliamentary opposition to this privatization and devastation of the economy leads to mass demonstrations throughout Haiti, prompting Michel's resignation. November 1995, citing delays in privatization, the United States suspends appropriated aid funds, and the International Monetary Fund, World Bank, and other IFIs withhold over $100 million from Haiti. June 1996, as they attempt to starve out the economy, the Haitian government signs the United States' $800,000 contract to sell privatization. March 1996, on the eve of his visit to the United States, President René Préval gives his blessing to privatizing all state institutions. April 1996, a high delegation from the International Finance Institution descends on Port-au-Prince to impose privatization as an exchange for resumption of any international assistance to Haiti. May 1st, 1996, mass demonstrations throughout Haiti against privatization. May 7th, 1999, Ciment de Haiti, one of the largest factories in the Caribbean, was auctioned off by the Préval government. Many condemned the sale because they never had his general policy, including privatization, approved by Parliament. June 28, 1999, longshoremen, angry over the privatization of Haiti's port authority, blocked the port entrance with cargo containers, erect burning tire barricades across the entire boulevard. The government plans to sell control of the agency. June 30th, the longshoremen's strike continues, resulting in the government's loss of customs duties. The workers accuse the port's director of selling out and demand an audit of the port authority's accounts. The five-member council in charge of the privatization effort is named the Council for the Modernization of Public Enterprises, and the privatization program is patterned on one in Bolivia with controlled transfer to investors through management contracts, concession of capitalization, joint ventures, and the phone company is then scheduled for privatization, as are the cement factory and the flour mills. 2 days of violent demonstrations begin at Altaleco, the Haitian telephone company. Plans to replace the company director, Julio Cadet, sparked the protests as the telephone company is now scheduled for privatization, brothers and sisters. This is a month-by-month, virtually week-by-week delineation of the devastation of the public sector of the Haitian economy, of the employment prospects of the population at large, of the rights of trade unionists and their capacity to function. These are the issues at stake. This is the reasons for the devastation of all governmental authority, the marginalization of Préval, and the usurpation of all administrative responsibility by the Marines and the military in Haiti.
Ralph, I want to return to the report that was prepared for the United Nations last year by Oxford University economics professor Paul Collier, to which you referred earlier in that New York Times editorial. Collier had been working for the World Bank. And this is a report that was submitted to the United Nations and was to be implemented by former President Bill Clinton. As Secretary of State Hillary Clinton remarked, Bill Clinton recently had a conference with 500 business people. They were signing contracts. They were making investments. Well, what were they doing with these investments? Because as Collier had said, quote, "Due to its poverty and relatively unregulated labor market, Haiti has labor costs that are fully competitive with China, which is a global benchmark. This is what the United Nations has in store for Haiti. Its reconstruction of Haiti, basically on starvation wages. And important to that is a new 10-year duty-free access to the American market. This means the influx of American goods. This is what happened earlier with the rice Haiti used to produce, the sustenance of the Haitian diet, rice. It used to produce its rice, primarily all its rice. Now, today, rice is imported."
And Haiti was food self-sufficient, brothers and sisters. Haiti sustained its own food production and fed its population. Now the population cannot afford rice in the hands of the U.S. food magnates and conglomerates. That's what's at stake at every level of economic subjugation and exploitation in Haiti. The suborning of the nominal government representing the population that signs on to agreements that devastate the people themselves. That's the content that cannot be denied or ignored because this is part of the loss of Haiti, the loss of Haiti to its people.
And Ralph, this also affects immigration, the clearing out of the countryside, because as the farm economy disappears, the small farm economy disappears, people don't have any work in the countryside, and they stream into the cities, particularly Port-au-Prince, and create a very low-wage workforce. I want to return to something we discussed earlier, which is baseballs, because it's a classic example of sweatshop labor. We had talked about Haiti being the place where baseballs, particularly for Major League Baseball, are manufactured. This was the case until the fall of the Duvalier regime. At that moment, Rawlings Sporting Goods, which has the exclusive contract for Major League Baseball, shifted its operations to Costa Rica. Costa Rica offered Rawlings a free trade zone area, in other words, no taxation and no import duties. And Rawlings moved its operation from Haiti to Costa Rica, paying barely above Costa Rica's minimum wage. In 1971, 7 million baseballs had been made in Haiti. There were 9 baseball plants, and women were earning 3 to 3.5 cents per baseball. Today, China produces 80% of baseballs worldwide, but all the Major League Baseballs are produced by Rawlings and made in Costa Rica in factories that have about 1,000 workers. Prior to this, when Haiti was the capital of baseballs, there were about 3,500 Haitian women employed by 5 U.S. sporting goods companies. And many of these companies have moved to China, except for Rawlings, as I mentioned, that moved to Costa Rica.
Maya, Haiti, Blood, Sweat, and Baseball by Jean Damu on the 21st of January, 2010. 2 days after the Haitian earthquake, a disaster now recognized as one of biblical proportions, Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig stepped to the plate. He said his organization was donating $1 million to the devastated nation. $1 million? Major League Baseball, in alliance with Rawlings Sporting Goods, conspired to destabilize Haiti after the overthrow of Jean-Claude Baby Dog Duvalier, moved their baseball factories to Costa Rica, as you mentioned, throwing thousands of Haitian women out of work. The professional sports organization should acknowledge their long, exploitative relationship with a devastated nation and made a much more significant donation to help rebuild a nation from which it has extracted so much money. This is a long article. The combined salaries of Major League Baseball players in 2009 was $2,655,144,214. This figure in the process of increase as 2010 salaries are being negotiated and arbitrated. Major League Baseball's $1 million donation represents then 0.04% of the players' salaries, let alone the profits of the owners. Let's just take a moment to examine what is the reality of this kind of exploitation that defines all economic relations of U.S. companies and international companies in Haiti. Rawlings President Tom O'Brien refused to disclose what he pays his employees, but said a lot of girls here more than double the minimum wage. It depends on efficiency. Howard, the Rawlings plant manager, refused to allow reporters to interview the employees or tour the plant. He said he didn't want secret production methods revealed. What is the reality? A Haitian woman can earn anywhere from 40 cents to $1 for every 1 dozen baseballs she stitches. It takes from 5 to 20 minutes to sew the 2 covers of baseball together. Each baseball has 108 double or 216 single stitches. Using a 15-minute average and a 70 cents per dozen pay scale, a woman can expect to earn $2.80 a day if she works for 8 hours without a break. Carrying out the calculations further, in 1977, an employee of a baseball factory in Haiti, if she worked 6 days a week, could earn as much as $769 a year. Meanwhile, in the United States, the minimum wage for Major League Baseball players was $60,000. Today, it's over $600,000. Earlier we said Major League Baseball and Rawlings had conspired to destabilize Haiti after closing their baseball factories. Workers in Costa Rica employed by Rawlings and through their secret deal with Major League Baseball earn even less than $1,000 a year factory workers in Haiti made. It's a good deal for Major League Baseball. The obscene profits generated by Major League Baseball and its partners in Haiti and elsewhere should generate, the article states, the public's outrage. A demand should be made to their offices that more should be done to help Haiti. More should be done to help Haiti. These people should be thrown out. There has to be a resistance to this raping of Haiti that is centuries old, brothers and sisters. It'll never end until the people are in struggle and then people are led to resist and resist until there is no longer a foreign presence in occupied Haiti.
Ralph, we should look at the structure of how this takes place with these free trade zones. And this was originally initiated in the Caribbean under Ronald Reagan with the Caribbean Basin Initiative and has continued with presidents from there on. In a free trade zone such as had existed in Haiti and which is proposed again by the United Nations and Bill Clinton and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, it provides access, which means that goods coming in to prepare the items come in duty-free and that the companies pay no taxes. So when it comes to baseball, that means that the cowhide that comes from Tennessee comes in duty-free, that the yarn that comes from D&T Spinning in Ludlow, Vermont comes in duty-free, and that the core, the rubber core that comes in from the Muscle Shoals Rubber Company in Batesville, Mississippi, comes in duty-free. It all comes into the free trade zone in Costa Rica, previously to Haiti, and perhaps once again to Haiti. And then it's all stitched in the country, and then it is exported tax-free once again to the United States. The New York Times, Tim Weiner, on January 25, 2004, noted low-wage Costa Ricans make baseballs for millionaires. In his article, he cites one of the employees. This is Overly Bungay, 37 years old. He makes $55 a week after 13 years at the baseball factory, barely above Costa Rica's minimum wage. After he pays for the necessities of life, he has about $2 a day left over for himself, his wife, and his daughter. His salary, adjusted for inflation, is about the same as when he started 13 years before. Ralph, let's turn to the issue of NGOs. And before I do that, I would like to say that one of the major ecological problems in Haiti has been deforestation, and particularly during the major hurricane a couple of years ago, the fact that Haiti's forests have been cut down created massive flooding. Now, this is usually blamed on the impoverishment of the Haitian people, but I did some research about the ecology of Haiti, and it turns out that the deforestation dates back to the French colonial period, and that Haiti was primarily deforested in order to create the large plantations, the large sugar and sisal plantations, and that a minor part of Haiti's deforestation, the rest of it, has been because of the lack of fuel and the cutting down of trees to provide fuel. But let's look now at the major issue facing Haiti, which is the destruction of the government and the fact that there are all these non-governmental organizations. Of the country's $95 million budget, $85 million is provided by the International Monetary Fund and ends up in the hands of these non-governmental organizations that constitute 80% of Haiti's governmental services. Incredible research has been done by Eve Engle, a Canadian writer and political activist, about this very issue of NGOs. Ralph?
Well, Maya, the NGOization is not only the blight of Haiti, but of every developing and third world and exploited country in the world. Governments are being dismantled. The state function is being absolutely emptied of content. all activity on the part of what would nominally be the role of the state in providing health and education and infrastructure for the society is no longer the right of the state or elected officials, but private organizations funded by corporations. Haiti's long history of international interference, which crippled the country's ability to sustain itself in times of disaster, as you said, Yves Angler has articulated this very effectively. Since the government coup of 2004, an operation organized in Ottawa by the Canadian, American, and French governments had the bulk of public services turned over to non-governmental organizations. The Haitian state was dwarfed in its capacity to provide public services. Quote, there was a plan from Washington and Ottawa to implement a neoliberal program of downsizing and effectively eliminating the state and channeling all money that goes into the country into NGOs. They erode the legitimacy, will, and capacity of the Haitian state and weaken Haiti's capacity to build or govern itself. Colonial and imperial interference of the country stripped the land of 99% of its forests, left Haiti exponentially more vulnerable to natural disaster. Exports of mahogany to Europe in the colonial period worsened when Haiti's plantations took over the economy. 75% of Haiti, which was forested when colonists first arrived, today 1.5% of the country. The IMF has seen Haiti's advantage as a place of cheap labor, Engler states. One of the positive effects of destruction of the agricultural sector is that it pushes people into the cities. Rural migrants are willing to work for low wages in the city and find themselves producing T-shirts in factories for less than $1 a day. Montreal-based T-shirt producer Gildan, capitalizing on cheap labor in Haiti and Honduras, keeps its production costs low by these means. Central to this, the NGOs.
Ralph, 70% of health care in rural areas is provided by NGOs instead of the state, and 80% of public services. Consider this. This means education and the basic public services. The imperial powers have imposed on Haiti these non-governmental organizations, and this is what has happened with the Hope for Haiti, the aid. $66 million was raised from the concert on TV, and this money is going to NGOs. It is not going to sustain the Haitian government and the Haitian people. This is the near privatization of all public services. I want to repeat, 75% of the Haitian population live on less than $2 a day, 50% on less than $1 a day. This is not the result of the Haitian people themselves. This is the colonial and the imperial project for Haiti.
The United States Institute for Peace, quote, at least 3,000 non-governmental organizations operate in Haiti as of September 2009. Struggling with insufficient capacity in the face of overwhelming poverty and disaster, the government is unable to coordinate or capitalize on what some in Haiti refer to as a republic of NGOs. As Yves Angler wrote, from the grips of the most barbaric form of plantation economy sprang the greatest example of liberation in the history of humanity, the Haitian Revolution, a struggle simultaneous against slavery, colonialism, and white supremacy. Defeating the French, British, and Spanish empires had led to the freedom for all peoples, regardless of color, decades before this idea found traction in Europe or North America. And he jumps forward. As we approach the five-year anniversary of the coup against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, there are three important lessons to be learned. Those responsible to protect, as it were, want to encode into international law a complete cover for imperialism, the dismantling of the state systematically. Western government and corporate-funded NGOs is an arm of imperialism, an NGO laboratory where Haiti has been the highly vulnerable society. NGOs have joined the Bush administration and a handful of armed thugs in calling for the removal of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and it is indeed the NGOs that led the way for the thugs and the Tonton Macoute and the Zanglan Dou. This is the pattern, non-government organizations dismantling the state. Under the aegis of the IMF and the World Bank, Maya.
Ralph, from 1998, the USAID and the United Kingdom's Department for International Development, that's the DFID, among others, systematically subcontracted to these international NGOs, including CARE, ActionAid, Save the Children, Oxfam, and Concern International. The purpose was to, quote, build civil society capacity. In other words, to destroy the public sector. And this is going even further with the new UN plan as developed by Paul Kalia, which is to establish this cluster of free trade zones for garment production. And this would go beyond the two that exist in Port-au-Prince and Ouanzimenthi. And these zones would be for the production of garments, that is, sewing materials, which would then come back to the U.S., the cloth having been imported into Haiti, and also for an export of mangoes. But there's another insidious plan, and that is to buy up, to create these private beach communities, as already have been established in Haiti, to make it into a tourist mecca. You may have seen the article about the Caribbean cruise ship that landed in the midst of the earthquake in this private beach. People swimming and enjoying the restaurants. This is a closed community. In other words, selling off parts of this Caribbean island for international tourist meccas. Ralph?
U.S. Marines back in Haiti, back to colonialism. USA Today, an article on Monday headlined, Marines studied their own history in Haiti, describing Haiti as a major part of Marine Corps law. We governed Haiti from 1915 to 1934 after an invasion force was sent to prevent an anti-American dictator from assuming power. Young non-commissioned officers governed Haiti without supervision. USA Today goes on to quote Lieutenant Colonel Gary Keim, commander of the Marine Logistics Battalion, who said, he and Marine officers have studied the history of the occupation before we deployed to Haiti. It was required reading. We've been here before, we've been successful before, and we view those years as the model for counterinsurgency strategy. We're here again, and we are in control, brothers and sisters. Smedley Butler, known as the indispensable man, was sent by Woodrow Wilson, who was keeping a careful and worried eye on Haiti during 1914 when four presidents of that republic were overthrown by the population and the Germans were threatening to intervene to protect their own economic colonial interests. In 1915, a new Haitian president was pursued by a mass of people and forced to seek sanctuary in the French legation. He was dragged out and killed as the masses rose. Now the French government threatened intervention, and Wilson told Secretary of State Robert Lansing an American occupation would give him the chance to bring law, order, and prosperity to this wretched people. They brought law and order, all right. They brought terror. They brought total usurpation of the economy. They brought mass killing of the population without stop. They targeted the CACOS, which was a popular movement of resistance with a program of assassination, and they did it relentlessly. And here is Smedley Butler's.
Smedley Butler's description on August 21, 1931, when he addressed an American Legion convention in Connecticut, and it was his first anti-war speech. He had been in charge of the Marines in Haiti. Quote, I spent 33 years being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer for capitalism. I helped purify Nicaragua for the International Banking House of Brown Brothers in 1909 to 1912. I helped make Mexico, and especially Tampico, safe for American oil interests in 1916. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenue in. I helped in the rape of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenlund
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, An Unnatural Disaster, The U.S. Crucifixion of Haiti, Part 2, The Destruction of the State. We'll be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. We'll be with you next week.
Filon bakh ni wala nga ne mandal.